This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, Neil Asher Silberman, is a historian who combines careful analysis of biblical texts with painstaking archaeological research to test the accuracy of some of the Bible's oldest stories. The results have sometimes been controversial. He and co-author Israel Finkelstein have raised doubts about whether Abraham and other Jewish patriarchs were actual historical figures, and they question whether the story of the Israelites' bondage in and exodus from Egypt ever happened. Their latest book is David and Solomon, In Search of Bible's Sacred Kings and the Roots of the Western Tradition. They conclude David may have actually been a bandit leader in the Judean hills, and it's doubtful Solomon ever built a temple in Jerusalem. Silberman believes that probing the historical accuracy of biblical stories takes nothing away from their moral and religious power. Neil Asher Silberman is a contributing editor of Archaeology Magazine and director of historical interpretation for the Enami Center for Public Archaeology and Heritage Presentation in Belgium. You know, among the earliest characters in the Bible are those called the patriarchs of the Jewish people, Abraham, his wife Sarah, their son Isaac and their progeny, including Joseph, who gets sold into slavery and taken into Egypt. Now, biblical scholars and many people of faith have believed for years that these were real historical characters dating the origins of the Jewish tradition, you know, back more than 4,000 years. You and your co-author, Israel Finkelstein, examined this. What does the historical record tell us about whether these were real people who actually walked the lands of the Near East?
Well, you're right to say that for generations and generations, scholars and people of faith considered this to be accurate history. I think that a major change has come over the last generation or so as archaeology has gotten more into the picture. And archaeology, of course, has this ability to perhaps not identify specific people, but really to identify a broader social context. And what we can say now is that on the one hand, there is really nothing that can convince us in terms of the stories that are told of those patriarchs that these were real historical events. On the other hand, we know from archaeology that many of the elements of the stage setting of that story, the place names, the kinds of customs that are described, even a detail as seemingly insignificant as the use of camels for caravans, is something that can be really placed archaeologically in a much later period, in fact, in the 7th century B.C., as opposed to the earlier date that was assumed for the historical patriarchs, something like 2000 B.C.E.
If, in fact, these stories seem to be set in a much, much later time, what does that tell us about where the stories came from and their purpose in the context of that time?
Well, we have to understand that these stories and traditions are obviously much older than the time they were put into writing. But in tracing the changes from memories to oral traditions to a written version like as we have in the Bible now, what we're talking about is the way a society or a people remembers that can give us much more insight into what the Bible represented to the first listeners, the first readers of that text. You're absolutely right. In so many of the most famous stories of the Bible, whether it's the patriarchs or the Exodus or the conquest of Canaan or the grand empires of David and Solomon, which our new book is about, all these things are quite clearly, they did not happen at the time as they're described. But that isn't to say that they did not have enormous significance at later periods. And instead of seeing the Bible as a one-time creation, we can actually use the Bible as perhaps the most important archaeological artifact of all. In its layers and in its stories and in the details it provides, it gives us perhaps the clearest image of how a people begins to collect traditions and focus them into a very finished, very coherent kind of expression of their own identity.
One of the subjects that you and your co-author deal with is the Exodus, which is certainly one of the most compelling stories of the Bible, with the 12 sons of Jacob and their families migrate to Egypt, where they become a strong nation and eventually conflict with the harsh and tyrannical Pharaoh. God rains plagues upon the Pharaoh. The Hebrews flee under the leadership of Moses, and after wandering 40 years in the desert, they meet at Mount Sinai and emerge spiritually united in a compact with one God. It's a real nation-forging experience celebrated every year with the holiday of Passover. Now, in evaluating the historical veracity of this tale, I mean, I guess one thing you can look at is Egyptian records, because the Egyptian society was literate and kept a lot of detailed records about its wars, kings, and other events. What does the Egyptian record tell us about the possibility of Israelites being enslaved and fleeing?
Well, of course, there is nothing that resembles the story of the Exodus with all its miracles and plagues and miraculous acts, as it's described in the book of Exodus. But archaeology tells us something else about the Exodus that in a way offers its broader historical significance. We know that from really the beginning of recorded history, and even before that in proto-literate times, there was always constant movement between the land of Canaan and the land of Egypt, basically because the climate and the weather and the agricultural conditions in Canaan are very unstable and unpredictable, and it's subject to long periods of drought, floods.
And just to interrupt, when we say Canaan, we're referring here to modern Israel?
When we say the land of Canaan, we're referring to basically what is represented by Israel and the West Bank. That area basically between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea that lies north of Sinai. And the land of Canaan is a very tough land to depend on because of the weather and the climate and so forth. Whereas Egypt, the land of the Nile, with a constant source of water, was always seen as an endlessly fertile place where people could make a good living. And there was constant back and forth between Canaan and Egypt over the ages. I think that the writing of the story, in which we have some very definite clues on when the story was written and to which sites it refers, was one of those periods in which Egypt was rising, the people of the kingdom of Judah, the people who identified themselves as the people of Israel, were very concerned with issues of law and freedom and the tyranny of a pharaoh. But it had nothing to do with the pharaoh that is described as Moses' adversary. Once again, it brings us to the 7th century and the period of King Josiah, an otherwise largely forgotten king, who was in the midst of an ambitious project to resurrect the greatness of the united kingdom of Israel. And the story at that time would have particular significance.
The Exodus story concludes with the Israelites wandering in the desert for 40 years and eventually conquering the land of Canaan. I mean, these heroic battles. To what extent does the historical record support that version?
Well, the archaeological record really gives us a dramatically different story. First of all, there are the obvious things that are wrong with the story. The biblical account gives a unified campaign under Joshua, systematically destroying the cities of Canaan within a relatively short period and then settling the whole of the land. Well, we know that the wave of destructions of cities in Canaan at about this time extended over some 200 years. This is quite accurately dated by the pottery and other archaeological indications. But even more striking is the fact that some of the cities that are so prominently mentioned, namely Jericho, where the walls came tumbling down, and Ai, where a great battle took place, were either unoccupied or unfortified at this time. So the physical stage setting is all wrong. There is absolutely no archaeological evidence of a unified military campaign. But what there is evidence for a dramatic and otherwise unknown social transformation. Precisely in the uninhabited areas of the homeland, far from those cities that Joshua is described to have conquered, an amazing demographic explosion occurred just at about the same time, somewhere around 1200 BC. In place of largely uninhabited hilltops and valleys, dozens, if not hundreds, of strikingly similar villages were constructed. So what we see archaeologically in place of Joshua's conquest is a long social transformation, where indeed a group of people conquered their promised land. But they didn't conquer it through warfare and siege. They conquered it, essentially, by establishing a new kind of group, a new way of life that came to be the basis of the kingdoms of Israel. So what we see in this case is perhaps the clearest example of where the Bible suggests the truth, but the details of the story are incorrect.
Now, I taught ancient history 20 years ago, and I recall it was that at the time it was treated as fact that around 1000 BC there was a flourishing kingdom of Israel with Jerusalem as its capital, and this corresponding to the glory days of Kings David and Solomon. Solomon built this elaborate temple at Jerusalem, and I'm wondering, what does the archaeological record tell us about the accuracy of that picture of Jerusalem? What were the conditions in Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside at that time?
Well, it gives a completely dramatically different picture. The archaeological surveys and excavations in and around Jerusalem show that it was a quite rural, quite undeveloped area with a large population of sheep herders, no real towns to mention. And in Jerusalem itself, it was really quite a modest highland village. Now, what this contrasts with is the biblical picture, where Jerusalem is the glittering capital of essentially a Middle Eastern superpower whose borders extended from Egypt all the way to the Euphrates, with the ability not only to mount huge trade and military expeditions, but also to build an enormous temple on the Temple Mount. What archaeology shows is something that was a lot more humble than that.
There was a piece in the Jerusalem Post in January reporting that another scholar, Eilat Mazar, had found what she has declared to be King David's palace. To what extent does this challenge or undermine some of your findings?
Now, archaeology is a funny thing, and biblical archaeology is even funnier, because there was a traditional approach of the Bible in one hand and the shovel in the other, where people would basically read the biblical text and dig and see if there was anything that they could somehow connect to the biblical text. Now, archaeology, as I'm sure you and many of the listeners know, is not quite that clear. When you dig, you find things that are very difficult to understand, tumbles of stones, destruction layers, and so forth. And while archaeology is quite accurate in charting the dimensions of a room or the numbers of pieces of pottery, the significance of those finds, I mean, in fact, what's interesting about the past is sometimes, for archaeologists, more a Rorschach test than a real indication. So when we came with the Bible unearthed, with the suggestion that had already been put forward by many scholars about the questionable accuracy of the palaces and the grandeur of the kingdom of David and Solomon, we hear in January of the discovery of David's palace. The discovery of a palace or a significant building of David, even if it were to be connected with David. And bear in mind, there are no inscriptions. There's nothing that tells us that this large building has anything to David. What would it really tell us to prove that the Bible is true? Would we point out the spot on the roof of this building where David spied Bathsheba for the first time? Would it tell us anything about the accuracy of David's reign as it is told in the Bible? Every piece of evidence from Jerusalem is, of course, valuable. But beware of spectacular discoveries that promise to prove that everything is true. It's another piece of the puzzle that must be combined with the general picture in Jerusalem of very modest buildings and no sign of international trade or even literacy, and the wider picture in all of the kingdom of Judah, in which the settlements are hardly larger than villages. So even if such a building could have been erected in the time of David, to call it a palace, to use it to verify that every word of the biblical description of David is accurate, is really using the archaeological evidence for much more than it deserves to be used.
I wonder if any of the research you have done is relevant to claims by Israel and the Palestinians for the occupied territories on the West Bank.
Well, you know, pro and con, the history of the Bible is often used as competing battle banners, and there are those that take political support from every discovery that seems to support the Bible, and those that take it from every discovery that tends to question it. I have to say that the work that we've done really is very unconnected with the eventual political uses, in the sense that the struggle between Israelis and Palestinians today is a problem that must be solved in the present. But I have to say that there have been those who have said to us, you know, your investigation of biblical archaeology has got enormous political implications, and for the cause of Israel, it's dangerous. Well, I think that kind of idea in itself is extremely dangerous and must be fought against. If we are to cut off any avenue of research, particularly something as relatively harmless as archaeology, in the fears of what the results may be used or exploited for, then we have really cheapened and really demeaned our own value as archaeologists to a society. And I have to say something also about the sometime very strong reactions that have come to our work, both the Bible Unearthed and David and Solomon, in suggesting that some of the biblical stories are not true. There have been all kinds of hysterical accusations that this kind of work is going to undermine the Jewish people or undermine Western civilization or all kinds of exaggerations like that. We are really part of a tradition that began more than 150 years ago, when the first geologists in Europe, Lyell, and then eventually Darwin, proved that probably, however beautiful the literary text of the opening of the book of Genesis is, the world probably wasn't created in 7 days. And over the last 150 years, there have been a number of controversies. First, as I said, in the Garden of Eden, then in the Tower of Babel, then a generation ago about the patriarchs. And at each of these battle lines, a battle has been fought, and inevitably the Bible has been seen more and more as a profoundly symbolic and powerful text, but not history. So what I'd say to all these critiques, we're just trying to do what archaeologists have often not done. Not take the Bible in one hand and a shovel in the other, but rather respect the coherence of the narrative of the Bible and independently use archaeology to explore and reconstruct the material development of society in the land where the Bible was written. Then the interesting part is to combine the two versions. And so what we're doing, I hope, has got value for anyone who is interested in finding out the how, the whys, and the wheres of so much of the Bible.
Well, Neil Asher Silberman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was great to be with you.
Neil Asher Silberman. His latest book with co-author Israel Finkelstein is David and Solomon, In Search of Bible's Sacred Kings and the Roots of the Western Tradition.